I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down the key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a foreign dynasty. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, very interesting program I have for you tonight. It's an interview with a good friend of mine, Jared Taylor. He's the founder of American Renaissance, which is an online publication. It was at one point a a print publication. And, of course, American Renaissance holds a conference which brings together some of the very best speakers and minds in the white nationalist movement, and these conferences have been occurring since 1994. Anyway, Jared is interviewed on a Nicholas J. Fuentes radio show about a suit that he has launched against Twitter for censorship. And I'm always all ears when anybody takes on these censorship monsters and tries to achieve some justice. So the rest of this show is going to be devoted to this interview between Jared Taylor and Nicholas J. Fuentes.
Tonight, and a great guest, a man who certainly needs no introduction around here, but I'll give him one anyway. The founder and editor of American Renaissance. He is one of the smartest, one of the best guys around in this movement doing activism for our people and our country. The great Jared Taylor, welcome to the show.
My goodness, I better live up to that introduction. This is quite a challenge. You put me on the spot.
Very good. Well, it's great to have you. This is the first time that you've been on the show, and you're one of the most frequently requested guests, and there's a lot of things that we have to talk about tonight, so I want to get straight into it. I know you've had a busy week, and for a very good reason. The first thing I want to talk about, of course, is your lawsuit against Twitter.com. And I got to tell you, this was incredible. I mean, we have been looking at this issue, the free speech issue online, as one of the biggest impediments to the spread and the the spread of our ideas for like 3 years now. I mean, it's been a pretty long time. I know many people can relate to this. And this was the first real breakthrough on the free speech issue in the frontier of social media. So I'm just going to quickly read through a few excerpts from the press release, and then we can discuss that. So you had a big press release on June 15th on Friday, and it described how Twitter, they tried to strike down your complaint. They tried to dismiss your lawsuit, but Judge Harold Kahn has allowed this to go forward. So now Twitter has 30 days to respond. The judge said that this was an eloquent argument. They said it gets to the heart of the free speech issue, and there is no other case that could be a clearer case of the public interest. And so it's a great victory. Congratulations, and tell us a little bit about the process. I mean, you're the man to ask.
Thank you very much. In some respects, I'm not necessarily the man to ask. The best man to ask might be one of our lawyers. Mm. But it's a pretty complicated business, believe me. We are suing Twitter under California state law. And we sued on several grounds. And in some respects, I was disappointed that some of the more wide-ranging grounds we sued on were denied by the judge. Now, later on, we can bring up these arguments. But these are arguments that would outright ban any kind of viewpoint discrimination on the internet. And that's very much our goal. At this point, the case is proceeding on somewhat narrower grounds, and it has to do with California's unfair competition laws. That's to say, the kinds of contracts that Twitter can enter into with its users, the kind of advertising that it held in, for example, a free speech platform, but now it turns out it's not a free speech platform at all. So it's a kind of false advertising. So the suit will move forward really on two grounds. One is a false advertising, that they claimed to be something that they are in fact not. They initially were describing themselves as the free speech wing of the free speech movement. In other words, anything goes. And when we signed on 7 years ago, they had a whole list, well, it was a pretty short list, of the only reasons that they could justify banning an account or removing a tweet. And that was such things as copyright violation, promoting illegal activity, selling drugs, for example, exposing private information if I were putting your credit card information on the internet. That kind of clearly objectionable, libelous, defamation, that kind of thing. But then, they said, as far as any opinions are concerned, absolutely anything goes. Well, now we know that that's clearly not the case. So this false advertising. The other is that the judge held that they may have the right, in fact, they probably do have the right, to ban certain accounts for reasons other than this kind of egregious, illegal, or unconscionable behavior. Well, basically illegal behavior, which is what their list originally was. But they said, if Twitter's going to do that, then they're going to have a clear set of criteria, and they absolutely cannot, as they now claim, reserve the right to kick people off anytime for any reason, which is what they are now claiming.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, I think, a huge victory. I know, you know, in terms of the number of complaints that you filed, it is now, I think, a little bit of a narrower case. Mm-hmm. I remember when you talked about this at American Renaissance, you brought up the California state law, which I thought was a remarkably creative argument about how Twitter constituted a public forum. And even private enterprises, private spaces have to be used for a public forum in the state of California. So although it is disappointing, I think, that it has been narrowed from some of those more creative arguments, I think that the judge recognized that Twitter cannot, in fact, allow, or cannot, rather, basically be above the law, where, as you say, they enter into a contract with their users and they can change the rules. They can ban you for whatever reason, no matter what. And even in the lawsuit, I think they sort of reluctantly said they could ban people for their race, for their sexual orientation. I mean, any class of people for any reason. I think that really gets at the heart of our problem. Because you look at many of the accounts, yours included, which was, I think, one of the most law-abiding accounts on this sort of dissident right-wing spaces, where you follow the rules, and many of us would be okay to play by the rules. But the problem is then we find out that, well, the rules are changed on a dime, and actually, you know, somehow you're qualified as somebody who's connected to violence according to their reason for why they took you out, and it was, you know, of course that was just nonsense. So I think that really gets at the heart of it. So I think it's very optimistic right now.
Well, yes, it is a very significant victory. Like anyone who files a suit, I'd like to win on all counts. Mm. And our lawyers are very, very happy that the suit is moving forward. And if it ever goes to appeal, which it very likely will, because if we win, Twitter's not just going to take this lying down, then we can re-argue the broader issues. And the fact is, we are asking a judge, in asking him to consider that a privately owned public forum should have a First Amendment obligation to permit all non-illegal speech, all legal speech. In other words, completely eliminate viewpoint discrimination. That's asking a judge to do something rather creative. And first-level trial judges rarely do that. It's at the appellate level that ordinarily you get that kind of creative judicial reasoning. So this is not a surprising outcome for veteran legal observers, but still, for a guy like me who's aiming for the top, it can still be disappointing, but the suit can proceed. That's a very, very encouraging thing. The precedent that we were trying to go for was the holding that even if a entity is privately owned, if it acts as a public forum, and in this case, it was a shopping center that was held to be a public forum for people walking around in it, going up to each other, talking to each other, and so the shopping center was not allowed to say, no, 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 you can't distribute leaflets, you can't look for signatories for petitions to the UN or things like that. And we thought, well, okay, if a shopping center is a public forum for that purpose and has to abide by First Amendment obligations, well then, for heaven's sake, Twitter, which holds itself out as a public forum, surely should be subject to this kind of interpretation. But as I say, that would be a step forward that a trial-level judge is very seldom likely to want to make.
Yeah, well, that's a great point that you make, because you're right. I mean, really what it comes down to is this issue of the First Amendment really being narrow in terms of its scope in the 21st century, whereas it covers papers and the press and some of the more legacy conventional forms of media. In the 21st century, when you have these major monopolies on social media, and they can ban whoever they want for whatever reason because they're private companies, we have a gray area, where the law isn't really being followed according to the spirit of free speech, which is that, as you say, you should be able to have a public forum on Twitter, which is much bigger than a shopping center in California. And I think the important thing that makes this a win is that it's proceeding. You know, this is the first time that social media censorship has been actionable under law, so that's a great thing.
Yes. It's a tremendous victory, and it means that we can move on to discovery. Mm-hmm. And for those of your viewers who don't know what discovery is, this means we can legally compel them to give us their internal documents on how they went about making decisions to ban people, and we can also put their employees under oath and make them testify as to what the process is whereby they make these really quite ridiculous decisions. As you pointed out, when they did ban my account and that of my organization, American Renaissance, the excuse they gave was that we were both affiliated with a violent extremist group. Now, in all of our filings back and forth so far, and there have been three or four different exchanges in very detailed matters, matters of law, matters of fact, not once have they ever attempted to somehow link either account to anything related to violence, nor have they ever even cited a single tweet of the thousands and thousands of tweets that we had emitted over the seven-year period that we were on the platform. Never have they cited a single tweet that they said violated their terms of agreement. So they did, in effect, back themselves into the corner in which they said, well, okay, maybe we can't produce anything that says they're really violent. We can't produce anything that shows they have violated our terms of agreement. So they have fallen back on this position. Well, we can ban anybody, anytime, for any reason. And as you pointed out, the judge said, well, gosh, then you could just ban all black people. You could ban all mentally disabled people. You could ban all women. And their lawyer said, well, Your Honor, we would never do that, of course. But yes, we have that right. And Judge Kahn said, no, I don't think you have that right. So the case will move forward, but this is just round one in what is likely to be a long battle. And I hope that it will certainly change the way these media platforms operate. And as you point out, we live in really an unconscionable era in which you have enormous corporations that control what is, in effect, the public square in terms of exchange of ideas, who have the right to say, no, I don't like this guy. I don't like what he says. He may be perfectly legal, he may be perfectly polite, he may be perfectly rational, he may be well-behaved. I just don't like what he says. And so I'm going to silence him. This is an extraordinary state of affairs. And oddly enough, Twitter, despite, if they were sued and they were told, okay, one of your Twitter users has said something libelous, genuinely libelous, and they are attacked for that, they would hide behind the defense of saying, no, 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 this is something that was tweeted by our user, not us. On the other hand, when it comes to our suit, they are arguing that they're just like a newspaper, and they have the right to pick and choose what goes out under the Twitter label. You can't have it both ways. And this is an argument that we hope to be able to make in court as well. On the one hand, they're saying, no, no, you can't hold us responsible for what's out there. And then they say, well, we are responsible because we pick and choose what goes out as tweets. So, you know, now that we've really got them in court and we can hold their feet to the fire, I'm very much looking forward to a favorable outcome. But this stuff takes time and, alas, it takes money. Our lawyers are working at cut rates, but they don't work for free. And so we are in the begging business once again. So I don't like to rattle the tin cup too much, but this is going to be a long and expensive fight. And if any of your viewers are sympathetic, they can certainly come to our website and help us out.
By all means, no, absolutely. It's such an exciting opportunity here and such an important frontier for what we're trying to do. You know, I could be on my show and doing my show, but if the social media companies, and it looks like we're headed in this direction, decide after 1 or 2 or 3 years that, well, you know, just general right-wing conservative thought isn't going to fly on our platform, it really puts us in a very difficult position to make political reform. So by all means, I would encourage people to go and donate, because this is, if not one of the most important, the most important frontiers for the dissemination of this kind of information, these kinds of thoughts in this period right now. So it's a very exciting time.
Well, and there's no question that all of these social platforms have been moving left, moving in the direction of censorship for the last few years. For 7 years, I, in American Renaissance, we consistently did the same thing, year in, year out. We tweeted about facts, we tweeted about our own activities, we tweeted about our take on the news, we tweeted about conferences, books we'd published, all in a very gentlemanly way. We almost never engaged in any kind of debate. We certainly never did any name-calling. And then for 7 years, we okay? Then suddenly, in December of last year, we're not okay anymore. And this has been the fate of many, many people, primarily on the right. So as you say, if these Silicon Valley companies decided, they could simply cut us off from the internet, absolutely cut us off. We'd be back in the dark ages. And as you know, of course, you live on the internet. You wouldn't exist without the internet. I date back to the prehistoric days when we actually had printed monthly publications, but the internet means that we have gone from a maximum monthly circulation in print of 4,000 a month to sometimes getting 400,000 viewers a month to our website and to our traffic, our YouTube videos, etc. So the internet is an absolutely essential part of your and my activity, and I think this is a very important suit to keep it open. And I would add that if there's still any honest liberals out there, they too should support us. Because after all, what if there's some kind of change? What if the wrong guys, from their point of view, take over and start banning them? This is a principled argument that all ideas should be present in the marketplace of ideas.
Right, and it's so absolutely critical in terms of, you know, we're not really competitive. When you think about it, that we're competing with people on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter with printed publications and Gab, you know, it just is, there's no way that we could compete. And it's funny that you bring up liberals and why they should support this and even some of the conservatives. And what's fascinating to me, and let me know if this is your experience, you have people like Dave Rubin, you have people like Ben Shapiro, you have these people on Fox News, and they champion the free speech issue all day long. On college campuses, they champion it for their guys. When it comes to us, you know, when we get ghettoized and we get kicked off and abused for not breaking any rules, for simply participating in the conversation with ideas that maybe are a little uncomfortable for them, you know, suddenly we find ourselves that we don't have a defense, we don't have a voice. You know, even you look at Breitbart sometimes, they'll do a big piece about conservatives being censored. they'll deliberately leave our names out of it. I mean, so do you get frustrated at the hypocrisy of even people on the right with this issue?
Oh, yes. Those are people especially who should know better. Because once you and I have been completely silenced, they should know that they are next in line in the crosshairs. They should be the ones being prepared to say, okay, we may not disagree with these guys, but it's vitally important their voices be heard. But no, they're not daring to do that. This is part of the sickness of the so-called conservative movement. Every conservative seems to think, well, okay, what I say is reasonable, but anything that goes beyond what I say towards the right or towards sort of any kind of racial orientation or towards any kind of even a religious orientation, ooh, that's too far. I'm the limit of respectability. This is a very sick and sad state of affairs, and that is why so often you get so-called conservative publications and organizations firing their employees when the left points out, ooh, this guy Jason Richwine, he once wrote a thesis for his Harvard PhD on a forbidden subject, something having to do with maybe race and IQ. And then, okay, Heritage, okay, sorry, yes, sir, we will throw this guy out the door. This kind of truckling to the left, I think, is one of the most contemptible aspects of the so-called conservatives.
Absolutely. And you would think that after 25 years of this charade that they would know better, right? I mean, these are supposedly educated people in think tanks, people in academia, and yet the basic pattern recognition, which is that kind of compromise, that kind of accommodation of the left, you know, does it ever really pay off? I think this is a great way to transition into the other thing I want to talk about today, which is the Trump executive order on the separation of the children of illegal immigrants. Here you have another clear case of the left is screaming like their heads are cut off. You know, there's Rachel Maddow's crying on TV. Everybody's crying. How dare you? And everybody's all up in arms. Yeah. And Trump says, okay, well, you know what? I will accommodate. We will end this pressure. And is the expectation that people will say, oh, well, you know, Trump is a great guy now. Hey, he was bad before, but now we like him. Now he's here. Of course not. It never works out like this.
No. People apologize. People do what they're told. And all the left does is say, hey, we got another scalp. Who's next? No, you can't win with these people. You absolutely cannot. And to me, it's astonishing the way the left has been just vituperative in, frankly, the most hateful ways about Donald Trump and his policies. There was an article in the Forward by a woman named Lavin. And what happened with that is that she was saying that we cannot even be friends with Trump supporters. Anybody who voted for Trump is basically a Nazi, a horrible person. And if you find yourself at the dinner table with a Trump supporter, you take your glass, smash it, and leave the room, because we can't even bear to be in the same room and be polite to these people who voted for Trump. What kind of mentality is that? This is the attitude they have towards us, and obviously, if that is the kind of typical just animus, the visceral animus that they hold for Donald Trump, obviously they're going to be even more viscerally animated against someone like you or me, and there is just no compromise, no dealing with these people. I don't think that the United States has been this far apart psychologically or politically, certainly since the eve of the Civil War. This is an extraordinary state of affairs in which there is just no dialogue possible with these people, and it is the champions of tolerance and diversity who are the most intolerant and incapable of accepting a diverse point of view. This is a kind of liberal bigotry that I think is probably without precedent in the history of the world, unless you go back to something like the French Revolution or the worst times, the Soviet Revolution.
That's a great comparison to these left-wing ideological totalitarian governments, because you're right, at the end of the day, it is about the issue of equality. It's about the issue of egalitarianism, and it is about race. And I've had so many conservatives, liberals, journalists, they always say the same thing, which is, I don't know if it's quite the race thing. You know, I've heard this from everybody. I really don't know if it's quite about race, but of course we know that there are two different worldviews in the country. You know, like you said, polarized in a way that they've never been before, where it's irreconcilable. Two different visions that are mutually exclusive. And so, given that the divide is so severe and that there is, it would be really hard to make these two things come together, what do you see as the future of the country? Do you see it as opening up into conflict? Do you see it as, well, one side is going to win and dominate the other? Do you see it as, well, the left has education, so maybe our side will just go out of existence? What is in America's future for this divide? Does it get healed? Do we have a divorce? What happens in your mind?
You know, that is really the big question of our time. And you and I are fighting on one side of this divide. And it sometimes makes me think, well, I used to be a lefty. And believe it or not, I was a pretty thoroughgoing lefty. And I read Witness by Whitaker Chambers. And of course, Witness was at one time a communist. And then he became disenchanted with communism, and he became an opponent of communism. But he wrote that when he made that switch, he thought that communism had such a powerful gust of wind in its sails, a just permanent typhoon backing it, that he, by turning against communism, was joining the losing side. Well, he was wrong. He was wrong. Communism is now all gone. And so things can change in a most dramatic way. It does seem that the left certainly has most of the media, most of the education. At the same time, whenever you see people with an opportunity to speak on their own, when they are not being browbeaten by the media, browbeaten by some sort of educational institution, when they have a chance to vote for Donald Trump, or when they have a chance to write comments, even on mainstream news sites, in an uncensored sort of way, there's an enormous amount of public sense, of common sense out there in the public. I think, again, we've probably never had as much of a divide between published opinion and public opinion. In other words, the things that most people say are by no means the things that the most, that the editorial writers, the talking heads on television say. So many times, I'm sure you found this, even in a liberal organization like the Washington Post or the New York Times, if you read the comments, the commenters have a vastly more realistic view of the world. They see things, they draw parallels, they see patterns that the authors of these articles are deliberately blind to. So that's a long-winded way of saying it may look like the other side holds many Trump cards, but just like the Soviet Union, up until the very end, looked like it could not be a more stable society. It crumbled in an instant. The current orthodoxy, I think, one of the reasons it's lashing out so viciously by means of these Twitter suits, by means of this utter vituperation hatred of Trump, it's because they have a sense that their orthodoxy, their control of what we all are supposed to think and do, is slipping. And every orthodoxy lashes out with particular viciousness and nastiness just before it crumbles.
That's a very well put way to say that. And I think it's so important that this is understood by the people in this movement, because I'm sure you know this as well as many people, because you talk to other people in the movement and people who have these feelings. And like you say, it is a sentiment that, although it's not allowed to be printed, although it's not allowed to be aired on television, it is felt pretty widely. And I think one of the biggest ceilings, one of the biggest obstacles, is this sense of hopelessness, of nihilism, this idea that the deck is so stacked against us, you know, why bother? Can we even do it? Can we even surmount it? Is it even worth trying? And so I think that is such an important point to drive home, essentially, that, like you say, history is like that. It tends to move very quickly, and, you know, they say about empires, they collapse very slowly and then very quickly, you know, in the case of the Soviet Union or France or others. And so I think that's such an important message. And yeah, go ahead.
Well, one thing I did want to say, I have been running American Renaissance ever since 1990. That's since well before you and many of your viewers were even born. And there was certainly a time, I would say, for the first maybe 15, maybe as many as 20 years, I felt like I was just making a record. I was making a number of points so that if some obscure researcher in the next century actually took the time to look into what people were saying back in the days when I was alive, they might find that at least a few of us were not all cowards and fools. I felt like I was just making a kind of historical record. I don't feel that way now. I've seen silence and lack of progress for many years. What, by comparison, what we see today is a remarkable burgeoning of websites, of Twitter accounts, of publishers, of people like you, people who are taking advantage of the media and the opportunities available to us now to get word out to all sorts of people who have never heard it before. And it is so much easier. Anybody with brains and a little bit of talent and persistence can have a voice. And that is why, to get back to the original subject of this interview, this Twitter suit, this way of making it a guaranteed fact that we are able to spread our views through these modern media is so important. But if we have this, we have a real fighting chance. And as I say, for the first time in maybe the 28 years I've been doing this, in the last several years, I've been very optimistic. People who have just come to this way of viewing things, they are easily discouraged by what is, in my mind, just a temporary setback, because compared to 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we are light years ahead, and we're going to continue to be that way.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I mean, it is about having a certain sense of proportion of where we've been and where we are now. I think maybe because social media makes everything move so much more quickly, I think people get kind of this tunnel vision of, you know, the world is ending right now. If we don't get it right in the next 30 days, it's all over. But I think you're right. If you look at the general trend over the past 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, we've gone nowhere but up. And oh, I yeah. think, absolutely. And I think that the establishment has worked so vigorously to silence us on the internet, to shut us down on Twitter, on YouTube, and everywhere else, is because it's working. I think they understand better than we do how fragile their system is, how quickly things could spiral out of control if your message, my message, other people horizontally in this movement gets out to a wider audience, the kind of audience that the people who get the stamp of approval get access to, what kind of chaos that would cause for the system that they've created. So it's such an important thing, and it's really inspirational to see that there are people that have soldiered, you know, you say that you started American Renaissance before I was born, that have soldiered on since the beginning and have seen setbacks and decades and slow growth, but I really am optimistic about where this is headed, and the lawsuit is a big part of that, definitely.
Well, you know, I don't mean to sound too excessively sentimental, but my feeling is that we should not chart our course of action after having weighed the chances of success in some sort of calculating way. I think you and I feel a duty, an obligation to what we know to be the truth. And once we have discovered our duty, then even if failure seems likely, that does not mean we deviate from our duty. And so I'm not in the business of always sort of playing the odds, figuring out, well, what are our chances today as opposed to yesterday? No, that doesn't matter. We know we're doing the right thing, and that sustains us.
Yes. Well, yeah, it's worthwhile, and that's a great point that you make. It's something I talk a lot about on the show, about this idea that, like you say, even if there was no chance, even if it was a slim chance, that's not why we do it. You know, there's nothing more that we could do than our best, than to try for those small opportunities. So absolutely. And then so the other subject I want to move on to, do you have anything else you want to get to about Twitter? Because I'd like to move on to a different subject.
By all means, let's move on.
Excellent. So I watched a documentary that came out on Netflix, which you starred in, or you were in it, earlier in June. And I wanted to just pick your brain about that presentation. I hope this isn't like a gotcha or like anything like that, but for those people that haven't watched it, I think a lot of people have heard of it. It was a documentary called White Right, Meeting the Enemy, by Dia Khan. And it had been released in December, but it was dropped on Netflix in June. And what was fascinating to me, because I watched this and it was really painful to suffer through it, because you were in that documentary, and so maybe it's a little unfair to talk to you about this, for less than 3 minutes. And so the first thing I want to ask you is, how long did they interview you to get those 3 minutes?
Oh gosh, I must have spoken to her for an hour and a half. I've not seen the documentary, by the way, but I understand I'm in some of the opening scenes. But that is very much what they like to do. They will talk to you for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and then they will try to pick whatever little snippet they can out of it, whether in or out of context, to make you look like the wicked and boneless, brainless person that they want to portray you to be. So I don't, as I understand it, I'm asked by her if I see her as my enemy. And then I'm answering to some effect as to, well, objectively, if things go on as you wish them to go on, then my people will disappear. But no, you personally are not my enemy. Is that a fair characterization of what I said? I'm sort of going on memory here.
Yeah, 100%, 100%.
Yeah. And but what was she setting me up as? And why at the beginning? You can tell me about this this documentary because I haven't even seen it.
Yeah, well, the reason I bring it up is actually because the 3 minutes that you were on, you were in on the beginning and also a little bit towards the end. The reason I bring it up is because by far you were the most eloquent, and even the few minutes that they chopped up, and I know Somal because I've been interviewed to a lesser extent, but you know I've been a part of that process where they interview you for 4 hours and they clip, you know, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, right?
Yes.
And the reason I bring it up is because they have you for 30 seconds at the beginning, towards the end. And in between you, they have the National Socialist Movement. They have Spencer. They have some other people with what I like to call lesser optics, you know, bad optics. And why I wanted to bring it up with you is really to just emphasize the importance of presentation, because I could tell that as a filmmaker like her, she listens to your work, she listens to your thoughts, and the facts that you bring up, it's totally reasonable. You know, anybody could watch probably that hour and a half interview or your speech that you gave at American Renaissance and say, this is a reasonable person, this is a reasonable way to think. But she trimmed it up, and not only trimmed it up, but put it alongside some of these other more unsavory characters. And what do you think just about that kind of juxtaposition all the time of, well, people who talk about a white homeland, about racial politics, well, they're just the KKK in suits. I mean, what do you think? Is that a fair comparison? What is the motive there?
Well, the motive is clearly to lump us all in the same boat. And the suggestion is, as soon as you deviate in the slightest possible way from orthodoxy on all racial or national questions, then you're effectively Adolf Hitler. That is the argument they're trying to make. And it becomes slightly easier to make that, or maybe significantly easier to make that, if you take a clip of a guy like me or like you, and then immediately show a cross-burning, or immediately show a bunch of guys Sieg Heil, then the aura is that we are all part of that. That we may not necessarily do those things, but we're just dying to, you know. My right hand is just, I gotta, you know, keep it down all the time, but it's tremendous effort, you know. And in my sleep, I'm goose-stepping. This is the way they try to describe us. And they will, the Southern Poverty Law Center, for example, says, I'm careful to avoid racial slurs. I mean, I'm just not in the business of making racial slurs, you know, as if they're all on the tip of my tongue. I'm just bursting to say all these horrible words, but I manage, at least when I'm on camera, you know, to avoid doing this. It's a caricature of the most dishonest kind. What I find really, really entertaining, and I wonder to what extent ordinary readers or viewers will understand this, but they will often introduce what I think is an entirely reasonable quotation from me by saying, and white supremacist and hate monger as designated by the Southern Poverty Law Center says this. And so you've got a real buildup. Watch out, folks. Whatever this guy says, it's going to be awful. It's going to be hair-raising. And then, unless they're going to quote me dishonestly, they have to say something I've actually said, and it's pretty reasonable. But I think a lot of people, if they're just skimming along, then the buildup is as much part of the effect as what I actually say. That, too, is a very, very common way of dealing with people like us.
Right. Well, it's fascinating that you bring that up, because you go to your Wikipedia page, and then I pull it up, you know, just to prepare a little bit, and the first line is, you know, Jared Taylor is an American white supremacist.
Right.
It says, right. You know, and according to what? So, and to me, that is one of the bigger obstacles in getting out to the public, getting out to a mainstream audience, is this idea that when you talk about white racial politics, if you spell it out for people with the data and with the theory and all the rest, it basically makes sense. You know, all we're saying is multicultural societies, multiracial societies don't really work very well. We want to live in a society that works. But it has, all of that lives in the shadow of things that are like you say, a caricature, things that are ugly and maybe a little bit out there, a little bit fringe. And so, to me, you look at the success of people who before were described as alt-right, now they're kind of called the alt-light, you know, these characters that are a little bit in the mainstream but still kind of on the outside. The key to getting out there is to maybe not go out of our way to live up to the worst expectations, live up to the caricature. And as you do, as many of us have for so long, you know, put on the shirt and tie and be a little bit respectable and put out a message that is as reasonable as it is. I mean, do you agree that that is a big part of getting the message out?
Oh, unquestionably. I remember reading some estimate that in politics or in salesmanship, the message is 50% how you dress, 40% how you look, and 10% what you say. Now, that's probably an exaggeration and a caricature, but people are hugely impressed by the package. And the contents have always come along with a package. And when you think about it, from whom would you want to buy a car? From whom would you want to learn a new idea? Whose argument are you going to be most likely to accept? It's very, very easy when we look back on our own experiences to realize that much as we may wish to be purely rational, purely objective, we are swayed by appearance, by presentation, by packaging. All of these things are, I mean, we're human beings. Much as we would like to think that everything we can evaluate in the cold and calculating reasonable manner, that's not the way human beings change. Human beings are emotional. They are drawn to things that have a kind of psychic appeal, an emotional appeal, something that reaches deep into them that's not necessarily verbal or rational. Now, these things are very difficult to control, but we can control our appearance, and we can certainly avoid doing things that we know are going to offend a vast, vast number of people. One of the things that I absolutely hate about how not only the left behaves, but the right as well. American politics is full of people who, in effect, claim to read each other's minds. This is true, certainly, of the left, who will say that Donald Trump hates Mexicans, or I hate blacks, or all of these motives. They have passed a law because of this. They can never attribute a rational or reasonable motive to people on the other side. The fact is, we sometimes fall for that temptation as well. I can't tell you how many people with whom I've discussed Angela Merkel. Of course, she's the Chancellor of Germany, and she has let in this wave of Muslim immigrants that's transforming Europe in what we think are horrible ways, and which the Germans likewise are finding to be horrible ways, and they're beginning to speak up about it. But people will say, gosh, she just must hate Germany, or she must hate Europe, or Europeans. She doesn't have to think in those terms to do what she does. I think in the case of Angela Merkel, she probably thinks that she's being very generous. She also probably thinks that she is atoning for Germany's past. Also, she's doing something that she knows will get the benefit of the worldwide press. She will be considered a hero. And I think also, if she even thinks in these terms, she might think that, well, all of these young men who, with the right environment and training, can become good little Germans, just like people who've been there for 100 generations, these people will make up for our falling birth rates. But primarily, and I think this is typical of the way Europeans and Americans behave, primarily I think she's convinced that she's doing the right and generous thing. She's not trying to destroy Germany. She's not trying to obliterate the white race. I don't believe that for a moment. Now, this is all based on my own external observation speculation. Of course, I've never met her. I have no idea what she's like as a person. But to attribute base motives to someone like her, or someone like Nancy Pelosi, or Hillary Clinton, it is true that objectively they are doing things that are very, very destructive to us, to our culture, to our people, to everything we love. But I don't think that we can expect to be taken seriously and judged fairly unless we take others seriously and try to judge them fairly, to accept their expression of their motives. Only then, I think, can we expect them to judge our motives fairly.
Well, exactly, and that's so key when you're dealing with, you know, maybe not world leaders, but when you're dealing with people that you know, people in your family, your neighbors, the compatriots that are going to make this happen, you look at a liberal, and I think that's a really fair take in terms of, you could look at a liberal, and we know what liberalism will beget for things that we love and care deeply about. But at the same time, we acknowledge that they think, like you said, that they're doing the right thing. And to understand and to communicate with that opposition, I think we have to be fair to it. Like you say, and you know, people say, well, the left comes after us, this and that. But in terms of the country, in terms of the people that are not the elites, that are not making these big decisions, I think when you're looking at just, and even the elites in some cases, I think if you're looking at other people, it does a lot of good to be fair and to come at it from that kind of understanding. I think that's a great point about those conversations.
And let's face it, in order for the country to change in the ways that we want it to change, more people have to agree with us. That means we are salesmen. And again, as I mentioned before, what are the effective ways to reach people and to change their minds? I think any kind of expression of mean-spiritedness, of triumphalism, of any kind of visceral contempt for others, all of these things are very, very off-putting. When a neutral or mildly hostile or entirely hostile audience comes to us and expects to hear something from us, they are looking for any possible excuse to discredit whatever we say. And that can be the way you look, the words you choose, your demeanor, and certainly I think people are going to find it much, much easier to dismiss what you say if you lose your temper, if you express yourself in ways that are insulting to others, if you don't grant the good intentions of others. All of these things are just going to give people who already disagree with us and who are looking for reasons to disagree with us an excuse to ignore everything we say. But all of this is difficult. It's very difficult. When people are insulting you, it's hard to continue to be polite with them. When people are making one crazy, stupid inference after another from reasonable points you're making, it is difficult to maintain your cool. But under those circumstances, I think if you can, that is the best way to present our messages. Now, the messenger is often very much the message. So we have to, well, this is another aspect of our situation. If we are in a position, in a group, and we have any control over who the public outreach, the public face of that group is going to be, we have to be ruthless about eliminating people who are not going to present the message in a useful way. This is something that is of key importance for larger groups. But you simply cannot let people who do not have any control of themselves be the ones that are the ones that carry our message and try to make our points for us.
Right. Well, that you say that we are like salespeople is really the whole point of it. I mean, once you understand politics in terms of goals, oriented around, we have these ideas, we have these ambitions, now let's achieve them practically. You understand that we have to win elections to do that. Like you say, we have to persuade people to agree with us. And, you know, many people call me, they say I sound like a used car salesman. And it's kind of true, but it also gets to the point of what we're trying to do, which is to sell, which is to persuade, which is to get people around our way of thinking. And I think the prototype for the kinds of people that have done this are like Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump was funny. You know, he was funny, he was likable, he talked like us. Even people who didn't like him had to kind of chuckle at some of his antics. You know, and in many ways, the things that he was saying were disarmed by the silly things. You know, they're trying to say, this guy's Hitler, he's bad, whatever. And he's going bing, bing, bong on his phone, and he's, you know, got this goofy haircut. So, I mean, do you think that's also a big part of it?
Yes, it is. An ability to say serious things in a funny way, with a light touch. That is a real gift. I wish I had it. When I get into a debate with somebody, I just get grim. I feel as though I'm talking about the most important things in the world. And it's difficult for me to maintain a light touch. There are people like, I don't know if you knew the writer, Joseph Sobram. He was a genius in terms of writing about serious things in a lighthearted way. Mark Twain, if you go back even further, he had that ability. H.L. Mencken did too. Occasionally you'll find someone who can talk about real life or death issues, but do it in a way that does not sound as though it's life or death. And if you can actually joke about things, be self-deprecating, you're absolutely right about Donald Trump. He's not often self-deprecating, but he says things that are funny. People that, things that convey to an audience, even a hostile audience, just how human, how real, how likable, how genuine he is. I think when he first came on the scene, that was one of the, a huge aspect of his appeal. Compared to all of these cardboard cutout politicians who have to have 5 different focus groups and 25 advisors to tell them what position to take on any issue of the day, he would just say, I say this, I say that. That's very refreshing. A real human being rather than some sort of computer printout, which is what all the rest of them are. Very refreshing. All of those things are important. And so our ideas, we have a tremendous advantage because we're right. And they're wrong. Now they have an enormous media enterprise. They have an enormous university enterprise. Most of the churches are backing what they say. But they're wrong and we're right. That's an enormous advantage. That's a key advantage. But we have to combine being right with a presentation that is as winning and as persuasive as possible.
Right. Well, and that's really key, I think, to the message, is that we're the good guys, you know? And I think a lot of times people get caught up in reveling in the fact that we are dissident, and we almost, in a way, internalize the things that are said about us, you know? I think it started out as a joke where we said, oh, yeah, you know, we're really hateful, we're really the racists. And then I think a lot of people forgot it was joking, you know, it was internalized, and that is such a crucial part of it, that our message is that we're trying to save society. You know, when we look at these white liberals who can be so frustrating, you know, I look at some of these conservatives at CPAC, these young men, and they're promoting mass immigration. I think, what a travesty, you know, we're trying to help you. And so that, I think, goes a long way. I think when you can look people in the eyes and say, I believe I'm doing the good thing, I believe I'm a good person, we have the right message. Like you said, 90% of it is going to be in that presentation. And the unfortunate part, I think, for, you know, what we've been finding out in the past couple of months is, like you also said, we have to be ruthless with cutting out the people that are going to do a bad thing. And you think about it in terms of like a corporation. You know, if McDonald's has a vice president who's out on the street, you know, running around naked with a lightsaber on the highway, you know, they're going to fire him because he's making the company look bad. And every organization knows how to do this, and I think and that's a big part of us as well.
Yes, and in the case of our movement, there are many, many different organizations, many people who are acting as spokesmen, and of course, if it's not in your organization, that's not someone you can fire. But you can put distance between yourself and these people. That's about all we can do. I don't think that as a general rule, it's useful to criticize people in public. These public fights, I think that just gives fuel to any opponent who is looking to try to find bad things to say about all of us. But yes, we have to be very careful about who we, in effect, endorse. This is a very delicate matter, and it's often, I think, the sort of thing that should be discussed in private rather than airing our disagreements in public. But whenever you have a dissonant message, you have to be particularly careful about how you convey it. That's always been the case. Anything that is out of the ordinary, out of the mainstream, you have to be very careful about it. That's one of the reasons why I think it's important. Also, if you have taken a dissident position on one thing, it's unwise to take an equally dissident position on something else. Because if you are, oh, the moon is green cheese, the earth is flat, or if you take some sort of position that's outside of the mainstream as well, that becomes yet another reason, oh, this guy's a complete kook. And that, of course, is the objective of our sternest and most resistant enemies, such as the ADL or the SPLC. They want to call us hate mongers on the assumption that once having been informed that we are hate mongers, that means the American public realizes our minds are unhinged, we are motivated by the basest emotions, and that's all they need to know in order to not even bother to listen to a word we say. That has been, I think, a very, very successful tactic for them. The SPLC will never sit down and argue with someone like me or you. No, no, no. They, at this point, because what they say is accepted by the general zeitgeist of our times, all they have to do, but although this tactic is becoming less and less successful, in the past, all they've had to do is say, this is one of our designated hate groups or hate mongers. And then that means the public at large, and certainly the mainstream media, don't have to take you seriously. That has been a successful tactic, but I think it's less and less successful all the time.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, they rely on delegitimization because you're so correct in that if a Jared Holt, if the SPLC, the ADL, if they sat down and actually had to debate the ideas, I think most people, conservatives and certainly I think a good amount of people in the middle, would find themselves agreeing more with us as opposed to this radical, cosmopolitan, open borders vision of them. So you're right. I mean, that is the biggest tool in their arsenal, but also, as time goes on and as they expand it, greatly to our benefit, when they apply it to people like Ben Shapiro and to Steven Crowder, and they say, oh, everybody's a white supremacist, everybody's a neo-Nazi, when it starts to lose its value. So
they really have overplayed their hand in the most spectacular way. The left, it's astonishing to me. They would be much, much smarter to stick to much more convincing targets. When they start saying that the scientific method is white supremacist, or that speaking in standard English, this is an oppression of Hispanic minorities, they've just gone too far. They sound like idiots. They sound like cuckoo birds. And the more they say that kind of thing, and the more, Black Lives Matter. I think Black Lives Matter drew more people into our movement than every video I've ever made, every article I've ever written, every book I've ever published. When they start behaving like that, more and more white people realize, well, wait a minute, things are not as we have been told. So when you get Antifa out there roaring around, burning things, and attacking policemen, and they're supposed to be the good guys and we're supposed to be the bad guys, I feel like calling up George Soros and saying, send those guys another couple of million, George. We want them to keep doing exactly what they're doing.
Right, well, and they say never interrupt your enemy when they're making a mistake. And a big part of the left since the election of Donald Trump has been they jumped the shark, where even left-wing people, and you saw this in the Midwest, you know, during the election, are saying, yeah, okay, we're for higher taxes, and maybe we're for democratic socialism, but we're not for, like you said, that math is racist and, you know, all this other wacky stuff. And
yes.
I think so often you see that we do kind of get in the way of them making that mistake, but it would be much wiser for them to, like you said, just carry it out, because in, you know, so much of it is, at the end of the day, to our benefit, persuading people the other side. And Black Lives Matter was particularly beneficial. So many people on my Discord server, my fans who I talk to, say, yeah, really it was when Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown and the Black Lives Matter thing came around, because they're being honest. You know, they're really, at the end of the day, being honest about what the left wants, which is this very aggressive, very racial kind of stuff. And yet there are people that want to say, well, we want to be just as distasteful as them. We want to meet them in the streets and do the rest. So
No. That's a terrible mistake. That's a terrible mistake. When black people get on Bernie Sanders' stage when he's giving a political harangue, and they make him say Black Lives Matter, and they say he better not say All Lives Matter, good grief, we couldn't get a better advertisement than that. And, of course, the mainstream media will never couch that in the obvious terms that it deserves. But ordinary Americans see something like that, and they say, well, what's wrong with All Lives Matter? Why can't you say that?
Well, that was Jared Taylor, and that's part of a longer interview on the Nicholas J. Fuentes Show. Very good information. Well, this is Paul Fromm, you're on the Fighting Side of Me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon, all of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada,
in the Maple Leaf Forever. From Britain's shore, would the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever.
rain, and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever.